You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 70 years ago, British India was divided into two separate states, India and Pakistan. This came to be known as partition. Massive numbers of people scrambled to try to get to the new majority Hindu and Muslim countries. And in the process, the resulting violence killed an estimated 2 million people, displaced many more. Today, modern-day South Asians want to make sure those personal stories aren't lost to history. And the 1947 Partition Archive Project has collected more than 4,000 interviews from people all around the world, including two from right here in Illinois. I'm joined on the line now by Rohini Ramakrishnan. She's the Digital Archive Manager for the 1947 Partition Archive. Rohini, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Rohini, maybe you can explain why and how this project got started.
Well, Nyla, the 1947 Partition Archive is a nonprofit oral history organization, and we got started in about 2010. The founder, Dr. Gunita Singhpala, realized that there was no existing single source of primary witness accounts of the partition, despite the huge impact that it had had on human life in the subcontinent. The numbers displaced by the partition are huge. About 15 million people are estimated to have been displaced, and 2 million people are said to have lost their lives. And despite this, you know, unlike the way the Holocaust has been documented, or the disaster at Hiroshima and Nagasaki has been documented through oral history projects, nothing like that existed for partition at the time. So the archive was established to solve this problem.
And I think, as you mentioned, with those other tragedies, one thing that stands out to me is that lots of young people whose parents or grandparents experienced what for many was very traumatic events don't hear too many stories about them because they're difficult to talk about. And I wonder for you, did you grow up hearing stories about this?
Well, my family personally was not hugely impacted by the partition, but the partition in South Asia is a living legacy. You know, it's something that the people in the subcontinent live with every day, and it's affected the relationship between India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh since 1947. But despite the living legacy of the event, it's not been taught very well in schools. The focus of the narrative, of historical narrative surrounding partition, has been on the reasons for why partition happened. The focus has been on political leaders, but very little has been talked about the human impact, despite it being the lived experiences of people in the subcontinent.
I wanted to play some of the audio that we have from two of the people who were interviewed for the project who now live in Illinois. And one of them is Sarabjit Rundava, who lives in Evanston. His father worked for the British government right up to partition, and he was trying to get from Lahore to Amritsar to meet up with the rest of his family. But at this point, making even short trips was getting really dangerous. And Sarabjit said that his father never talked about this, but here's what his mother said to him, or told him about it.
So my dad's orderly was a Muslim person. And my orderly knew the way around Lahore pretty much a darn sight better than my father. So he led him through the back streets. They went to the train shuttling yard. And my mother told me that what the orderly did was he was able to lash my father under the train. And so I presume that my father must have found some reasonable place under the train where at least he could get some foothold. Mm-hmm. But he was tied up with a rope, mm-hmm, so that he didn't slip down, mm-hmm, and essentially kill him.
That was Sarabjit Rundava. That's a really incredible story, Rohini, talking about how his father, his story of how he was snuck through Lahore and tied by rope to the bottom of the train just so he could get to Amritsar safely. And I think for a lot of people who aren't directly affected by this, it can be really hard to comprehend what it was like for two separate countries to be created at the stroke of midnight, millions of people trying to get to new places all at once. Can you just explain for people who aren't familiar with the history how much notice people had beforehand? Sort of how did this all come about?
there were rumors surrounding partition for a very long time, and an announcement was made on the radio, and some people have recollected memories of hearing that announcement, saying that that the countries were going to be that Pakistan was going to be an independent country for a Muslim majority. But I think despite the official announcement, before and after the announcement, there were rumors spreading, and that created confusion and also panic.
And what, we just heard Sarabjit's story. In a minute, we're going to get to another gentleman, Yogeshwar Sharma, talking about how to get on the train and how dangerous it was. What was it like for people who are trying to migrate? Were people mostly trying to do this by train?
Well, there's different ways that people migrated across the borders. Migration by train was a big way for people to travel, and we've heard some very difficult stories narrated by partition witnesses of some very violent journeys. We've heard of people speaking about going to receive families at the railway stations, only to see that the trains arriving are full of bodies, massacred bodies in the compartment. We hear stories like this, and so there were migrations by train, but people also did migrate by road in long caravans. So you'll find old photographs of people in very long processions migrating in what they call kafilas. People also migrated by ship, when it was from port cities like Karachi to Mumbai. And also by and the more privileged people, more privileged people at the time were able to maybe fly out as well.
I wondered if we could hear a little bit from another Illinois resident who was interviewed for this project. Yogeshwar Sharma now lives in Naperville, just outside of the city of Chicago. He was only 4 years old when partition happened. But here he talks about what it was like after partition and how his mother wound up taking care of his cousins and so many others in his extended family who lost their parents.
She tell my cousin, "You go, he not coming." Now, because my cousin had no mother, because my aunt, she died in Pakistan, maybe in the late 40s. So my mother took care of my cousin family too. And he will just leave, then I have to leave too, because otherwise the teacher will beat you, why? But those are the days I still remember like it happened yesterday. And I tell you, it still make me cry.
That's Yogeshwar Sharma, his story, Naperville resident, for the 1947 Partition Archive. It's an oral history project that we're talking about, a reminder of archiving the stories of what happened 70 years ago this month, when British India was divided. Rohini, I mean, when you hear that and you hear it, obviously, as you've just been saying, there's so many of these stories are so emotional. These interviews are 1 to 2 hours long, maybe even more. What do you think are there common themes about the ripple effect that this had on families that have emerged and sort of things that you think are important for people to understand?
Absolutely. I think one thing that we've seen, across many interviews is that the people who experienced partition at the time were forced to leave their homes for a new place. And leave everything behind, leave their homes, leave their belongings, and lose many family members or friends. Many of them describe that they always thought that they would return, that they would always return to their homeland or their village or town that they were from. They never thought that partition was permanent. They never thought that this migration was permanent, and that their resettlement would be a final thing. So many of them imagined that they would always be able to return. And so we've always we tend to hear from people narrating these experiences that they wish they had the chance to visit their homeland, or where they were born, but they just aren't able to do that now because of different visa restrictions or, just the political strain between the different countries.
Right. And when we think about folks like Yogeshwar Sharma, who then made a third migration, right? Because all of these people then these folks who we're hearing from who live in Illinois then made another migration at a certain point here to the US. I wonder how much of the themes of those of people you've been talking to people all over the world, how many, what percentage of your stories are folks that have gone to Canada or the US or Europe and are not still in the region?
Well, it's hard for me to give you a percentage, but we've recorded stories in about 22 different countries, in 22 different languages, in 12 different countries. We do interview many people in the South Asian diaspora across the world, whether it's in America or Europe, in different parts of the world. And what we do find is, the younger generation conducting the interviews are often very interested in learning about the histories which they haven't heard their families talk about, because there is a lot of silence surrounding partition in many families that experienced it. So we do, when talking to the diaspora, the younger and older generations, it's an exciting project for many people living outside South Asia even today, because it lets them talk about something which they may not have spoken about in a very long time.
And the way that you do that, do you encourage then family members to interview each other and record it and give it to you?
Yes, we actually have an online oral history workshop, which is a free workshop which anyone can attend anywhere. And we invite family members, the younger generation, to attend the workshop to interview members in their own family, like their grandmothers or grandfathers. And we find, we often hear from the interviewers that this is a very enriching experience for many of them, because they get to learn a lot more about their family members than they may have known before.
And what do you think is lost if these stories aren't told, Rohini?
Well, for a long time, like I mentioned before, the human impact of partition hasn't been studied and understood enough. The only way we can really understand, what people went through and what happened at the time to different people is through understanding the individual experiences. And this can only be done through this kind of intensive, oral history interview method. And if we don't record the stories now, these interviewees, these partition witnesses were born before 1947 and are in their 80s and 90s now. If we don't record the stories, they will be lost forever.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this is something that people get taught in school. I wonder what, for you personally, what you've learned about your own history and heritage through collecting these stories. Has it changed the way that you think about this historical event?
Absolutely. I think I learn something new every day from engaging with the interviews, and also by talking to other partition witnesses or the people conducting interviews. We learn that, for one thing, irrespective of what side of the border you came from or you currently are living on in the subcontinent, the experiences, we have these shared experiences which do unite us in a way, in the sense that, everyone went through hardships. Everyone who was impacted by partition saw a lot of violence and went through hardships, which we need to remember and understand that, it was something that affected a lot of people. And that's something which I think needs to come out a bit more. And also, one more thing that does stand out is apart from the violence that people experienced and the brutality, the compassion that was shown by people, the stories, for example, like in Sarabjit Randhawa's father's experience of being helped out by his helper at home, a Muslim helper. In the same way, we've heard numerous other stories of people being helped out, being protected or, given security by members of other religious groups. So that's something that does stand out as well.
Right. So not only the stories of Muslims and Hindus helping each other, but I guess also what you're saying is that no matter what side you ended up on, even though there's still such of a divide today, most people had very similar experiences.
Yes, absolutely.
And now, are you still looking for more people to take part in this project? Is it still possible for people to still record these?
Oh, definitely. We'd love to have more people sign up, and we do make it possible through the online oral history workshop that we have. It's a free workshop, and it trains you in the basic methods of conducting an oral history interview. We schedule them quite frequently. So anyone who wants to record stories with us is welcome to join the workshop. And anyone who wants to have their story recorded, we have people writing to us all the time asking us to record their stories in different parts of the world. So we try and connect them with interviewers in their area to make it possible.
Mm-hmm. And so they can go to your website, that's 1947partitionarchive.org, for more information on that. We'll have that all at our website, and we'll tweet that out as well for those of you who are following us. I want to thank Rohini Ramakrishnan. She's the Digital Archive Manager with the 1947 Partition Archive for joining us. Thanks for being with us, Rohini.
Thank you so much, Milo.
Stay tuned. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. To this encore edition of The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're feeling nostalgic for summertime and maybe your outdoor grill, you're in luck because we thought we'd take some time on the show to revisit one of our favorite conversations from Labor Day weekend. It's about all things barbecue. Whether you're a home cook or you just want to get a bite to eat anywhere in the state, which you can do even now, we've got some great suggestions for you. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by a few chefs from some of the most popular barbecue places throughout Illinois. They're going to discuss what makes their food unique and share tips for those of you who want to up your barbecue game. But first, I'm joined by Nuno Ribeiro, who's a huge barbecue fan and also an assistant professor of recreation, sport, and tourism at the University of Illinois. Also joining us is David Rowe. He's a board member of the Illinois Barbecue Society. Nuno, David, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. It's a pleasure to be back.
Good morning, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Nuno, let's start with you. I think we should start off by acknowledging Illinois is not widely known as a barbecue state. And if you were going to look for good barbecue, lots of people think you have to head to either St. Louis, which certainly has that reputation, or Chicago. And I wanted to ask your opinion if you think about what your opinion is about if our closest big cities are the only places to find good barbecue in Illinois.
No. There's no doubt there's a very fine barbecue to be found in both Chicago and St. Louis, but you have numerous places throughout the state that have excellent, superlative even barbecue that you can find sometimes in the smallest of places.
And Nuno, when did you first become a fan of barbecue?
Well, I moved to Illinois about 3 years ago. I think I've always been a fan of barbecue, no matter where it is made, provided it's good. I have no prejudice of any kind in regard to barbecue. I like all kinds. And I'm a bit of a foodie, so whenever I hear about a place that might have good food, I'm definitely willing to travel and to make the effort and sometimes get to know the location. I travel a lot for my work. And I had a friend who happens to be from Paxton, my good friend and colleague, Sally Marshall, said, "Hey, you know, I'm from Paxton. There's a place there opened up that's really, really good." And it was the Humble Hog. And I went there, and I've been a fan ever since. And I've just been expanding the radius of my barbecue forays, which I might say very positive and very delightful successes.
The Humble Hog is going to be Benjamin Grice is going to be joining us later on in the hour. He's the owner and chef of the Humble Hog in Paxton. Paxton's about 30 miles north of Champaign, for folks who are wondering about that. David, what does the Illinois Barbecue Society do?
Well, our focus is primarily on education and supporting the backyard barbecue enthusiast, the barbecue pitmaster, and just generally raising the level of education of barbecue in Illinois. As Nuno said, it's not known as a barbecue state in the past, which is a little bit unfortunate because Illinois actually has a rich history of very strong barbecue presence. Everything from the Weber Grill based in Illinois to Sweet Baby Ray's sauce came out of Illinois, along with a number of other noted barbecue events. So it is unfortunate that people don't think of Illinois as a barbecue state, but it truly is. And the type of barbecue covers a broad range. So it's our goal to hopefully just to educate people, put people either into restaurants if they want to visit different restaurants across the state, or help educate them on how to cook their own barbecue in their backyard.
So let's talk about sauce, David, because that always is the either the contentious, depending, or the defining characteristic oftentimes of barbecue. What kind of sauces do we see across Illinois?
You bring up a good point, because there are a group of people that like the dry rubs, and sauce never touches their barbecue. Illinois, in general, is a sauce state. People generally put sauce on during the cooking, or they add it after. And because of that, the sauces across Illinois, from the best we can estimate, there are about 30 to 50 commercial sauces made just in Illinois. And we know this from running the National Barbecue Sauce Championship here in the United States, which is one of the largest sauce championships that's a standalone event anywhere in the country, where we have upwards of 200 sauces submitted every year that we evaluate and taste and go through, covering everything from the sweet tomato sauces, which is pretty prevalent in Illinois, all the way down to some of the vinegar sauces or the mustard or mayonnaise-based sauces, which aren't as prominent in Illinois, but certainly offer a little bit of variety. So the sauces in Illinois typically cover the sweet tomato and the spicy tomato sauces. Again, very similar to the sweet baby Ray profile of flavor that a lot of people like. So we've had an opportunity to taste, I've probably tasted upwards of 500 different sauces. So I like to think that I've got some exposure to what those sauces taste like and what makes a good sauce and a bad sauce. And people in Illinois have the unique advantage. Many retailers, including things as Ace Hardware or some of the other small food shops, carry a lot of these local regional sauces on behalf of some of these sauce companies across Illinois. So it's a real opportunity to go into just about any store and pick up one or two unique local barbecue sauces to taste.
That's David Rowe with the Illinois Barbecue Society. We asked you your favorite barbecue, so let's go to a caller or two before Nuno. I want to hear from, as we've been talking about sauce, what your favorite kind of sauce is. Ted from Springfield has a suggestion for us. Hey, Ted, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Ready to talk about barbecue? What's your favorite place to go to?
I love barbecue. I used to eat barbecue 4 days out of 5 days a week.
Wow.
Every lunch. Yeah, and the reason, they were closed on Monday, and so I couldn't get there.
And where'd you go, Ted?
Clay's Popeye's Barbecue on South Grand, just east of 11th Street, right here in Springfield.
Okay, so Clay's, you said.
Yeah, Clay's everybody knows Popeye's Barbecue. Yeah,
all right.
It's been around for forever in Springfield.
Well, thanks for that. I appreciate that, Ted. Nuno, what about you? Where are some of your favorite places that you like to go? Let's start with, we just heard from Springfield. Where are some other places you like to go in the Champaign area?
We actually have a quasi-barbecue capital of the state, which is in Murfreesboro, Illinois. And I believe they have 4 or 5 barbecue places in the medium-sized or small-sized town, so I like to go there quite a bit. There's also a place in Dwight, Illinois, Cherry Red Roosters, that makes excellent barbecue. And to answer your previous question, what kind of sauce do I like, I'm actually a fan of dry rub. I like to try different sauces. I typically ask to be put on the side, and I'm fairly adventurous, so I'll try just about anything. But I tend to like my barbecue with sauce on the side or without sauce at all.
Right. We could talk about this one for a whole hour. I bet people arguing
could.
About whether they want with sauce or no sauce with their barbecue. Let's go to Sam, who's also on the line from Springfield. Hey, Sam, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you. Well, talking about Murfreesboro, I didn't know there were 4 or 5 places there, but after viewing the eclipse in Carbondale, I went over to Murfreesboro and stopped in the 17th Street Barbecue, which was packed with people from all over the state who went there after viewing the eclipse, and really great food. So that's I don't know what the other 3 places are in Murfreesboro, but that place is really good.
Oh, so 17th Street. Thanks for that, Sam. Nuno, you mentioned Pats, right? And Pat, right. Actually, Pat's also going to be joining us later on in the hour as well. Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois, as Sam was just mentioning, obviously they've probably got lots of folks down there for the eclipse. So 17th Street was another one. What are the other two that you, Nuno, that you were
if
thinking
of?
If
my memory serves me correctly, another place is Bandana's Barbecue. There's another mom and pop's place. I want to say Jones. Perhaps it was a local thing, and the last one is escaping me, I'm afraid. The best thing to do really is just to travel there and discover them and test them all by yourself.
Yeah, Nuno, so how do you judge if you're just sort of driving around? So you don't do this. It sounds like you're not doing any social media or web research before you're trying to find a barbecue place. Are you doing this?
Every now and again, I might look at some social media customer reviews, but I tend not to. A lot of it has to do with my professional career and how much I travel inside the state for my job. I'm a tourism professor. And typically it's through word of mouth. You know, someone will tell me, hey, have you considered going to this place or that place? And that's more or less how I discover them.
So did you judge it just by exterior appearance? Because I have a judge by exterior appearance and smell, whether or not I think it's good.
I think the smell is very good. I'm not sure exterior appearance is necessary. Sometimes in the most unassuming places you find
No, that's
the
what
best
I mean.
Barbecue.
Oh, exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah,
absolutely.
I want it to look fancy. I feel like if it looks fancy, it might not be as good.
I think
that's
that
my
ultimately
opinion.
It has to do with taste. If it's good barbecue, I think smell is a great indicator. If there's a lot of people hanging out, if you see a lot of people driving off the road to wait for this barbecue, if they run out of barbecue, that's another very good sign. And you have to taste a lot of barbecue, which is quite of a delicious endeavor.
Well, David, I want to ask you your tips on that in a minute for how you go through tasting all of these different sauces. But let's get to a couple other folks with recommendations. Let's go to Dan, who's also on the line from Springfield. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Where do you recommend?
I recommend Kags, K-A-G-S, out of Danville. They basically do most of their stuff out of a truck and move it around town. I think they may have a location there, too. I've never been to it. But.
And what kind of style is it? What is it like?
It's they do a lot of the sweeter sauce, but I always get that on the side. I just find it to be very, very flavorful. I mean, it's just good stuff. Prefer the chicken and the ribs, but those are things they do real well.
Okay.
For years and years and years and years.
So that's Kags in Danville. Thanks.
Kags.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. That's a good one.
You bet.
So, David, when you said, did you say, David, you've tasted 500 maybe or so barbecue sauces in your lifetime?
I'd have to estimate it somewhere near 500 different sauces that I've had an opportunity to taste, yes.
Right. So I'm curious, I mean, it's very interesting nowadays. I feel like we're also seeing a lot of different things, whether we're talking about Black Dog and Champagne or Smoke. In Chicago, like lots of different other flavor kind of elements that are being incorporated into sauce. I'm thinking in particular of different like kind of like fruits like cherries and things like that. Is that maybe like a more modern thing or has that been a traditional part of barbecue?
No, I think it's a little bit more modern thing as people have tried to differentiate their product from others. They add in different flavors, trying to explore different flavor profiles. Some of them have been successful. Some of them have, frankly, been a disaster. Some of the sauces, I have to admit, are horrendous and very difficult to even eat.
Right. Really, you shouldn't mess with it too much, right, is basically probably what you're saying.
Well, I think small steps until you serve it to friends and family, see if they like it. And most sauces start out that way, and then they go to the local market or the Sunday farmer's market where they start to bottle it and sell it there. And if it takes off, if people like it, that's a great indicator, but small steps are probably better. Some of the better ones that have won in the past, we have Southern Bells, I think they're out of Pennsylvania, and they had a blueberry sauce that did really well. They won, I believe, this year as a national champion with a peach sauce. So there are some flavor profiles that people really like, as well as the traditional sauces.
And when we think because we're in Illinois, David, do you think we get, like when you're talking about Sweet Baby Ray's up in Chicago, that's a really sweet, more southern style versus I wonder what we're seeing across the state. If you can get Memphis, which is more, or Texas or Kansas City, St. Louis, can you basically get all of those different styles throughout Illinois?
I think that you can. Nuno probably can provide a lot more information on that than I can. But I think that there's a slight variation as you move further south. It does become regional, and so you get the sauces that are not as sweet. I think the sweet sauces probably are much more prevalent to the northern part of the state with the Sweet Baby Ray's area, particularly up here. It came out of Chicago. Sweet Baby Ray's restaurants, there's two of them in the area up here that serve very good food. Interestingly, Dave Raymond, his nephew, Deuce Raymond, has a couple of sauces out right now that he has won some very prevalent national awards on, including this year he won the Illinois People's Taste Award in the barbecue sauce contest, which I'll just mention very briefly. Our contest is a double-blind contest, so the judges have no idea whose sauce they're tasting. And he came out very well. So there's a little bit of family lineage, I think, going on there. But definitely the sauces to the north, a little bit more prevalent on the sweeter side.
Now, you guys are working on putting together a barbecue trail coming out next year for people who want a road trip throughout the state. David, can you tell us about that?
Yes, we've borrowed liberally from the wine industry, both in how we approach the tasting of the sauces, looking at appearance, texture, a savory component, flavor profiles, etc., and also the concept in the food tourism idea of creating a trail or simply a collection of restaurants that people, if they chose to, they could drive from restaurant to restaurant along the trail and explore different barbecue. We've added in restaurants, not only just the most famous ones, but also ones that offer a unique aspect. For example, maybe they're a small, out-of-the-way place. They run out of barbecue by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a place you'll have to get there early for lunch and try out some of their barbecue. Or in the Chicago area, even the types of cooking methods. There's an aquarium cooker, which looks like a big fish tank that is kind of unique to the Chicago area, and it takes a very good pit master to run that. It offers a slightly different method of cooking, so the style of cooking can change. So we look for unique aspects to add to this, and we have an outer trail and an inner trail. The outer trail covers the entire state in roughly a loop of about 1,000 miles. The inner trail focuses on the northern Illinois area, and those are a trail that we anticipate having posted on our website early January to February.
Well, we have to take a break. I want to thank David Rowe for taking some time to join us. He's the board member with the Illinois Barbecue Society. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Nuno Ribeiro and you, your calls. Some of you who are calling, we're going to get to you. Just on the other side of this, if you hang on for a few minutes, stay tuned. Labudu, thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois. Thanks for listening to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about all the best barbecue in Illinois. We were just speaking with Nuno Ribeiro from the University of Illinois and David Rowe from the Illinois Barbecue Society about some of their favorite spots. In a minute, we're going to be speaking with a couple of the chefs from restaurants who've already been named as favorite places. Let's go to Kent in Charleston. Kent, what's your recommendation of your favorite place to eat barbecue in Illinois?
Well, we've got a nice one here in Charleston. It's called Smokey's House Barbecue, and they serve, you know, brisket and pork, and they also have chicken and turkey and sausage and stuff like that. The thing I kind of think a little bit unique is that they also give you a whole bucket with different kinds of sauces, from hot mustard to sweet, there at your table, so you can add more if you want.
Okay, thanks for that, Kat. We've got George from Champaign on the line. Hey, George, what's your comment?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey there.
Hey, I just had a quick comment. I know that we're, in Illinois, the land of the Chicago-style hot dog, and ketchup seems to get a pretty bad rap. But I don't think that a lot of people realize that most of your barbecue sauces, like your main ingredient, is going to be ketchup.
Thanks for that. That's a good point, George. That's George in Champaign. He's right. Even in Illinois, we need to put ketchup in our barbecue sauce, even if we're not going to put it on our hot dogs. Let's actually bring in a couple of chefs from these restaurants. They are here to share their stories and offer some advice. So you can call us as well if you have questions for them. Benjamin Grice is the owner and chef of the Humble Hog in Paxton. That's about 30 miles north of Champaign. Pat Burke is the owner of and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering in Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois. Hey, Ben. Hey, Pat. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Good morning to you.
Hey, Pat, let's start with you. We were just talking to Dave and Rowe about from the Illinois Barbecue Society. He was talking a little bit about some of the competitions they put on. You opened your restaurant in 2002. I understand you've been competing since the late 80s. What first sparked your passion for barbecue?
Well, we started in 1988, and through the competition barbecue, we got off into, like I say, in 2002. I've been doing barbecue since I was a kid on the thing. So, of course, Murfreesboro is now the barbecue capital of Illinois, too.
And we've been talking about sauce. Can you tell us a little bit about the sauce and where you stand on the sauce and where it goes and what your style is?
Yeah, we've got a sweet sauce, and it's whoever's talking to you before. We ketchup is the main part of it, you know, with the ketchup and vinegar, Worcestershire, and all the seasonings and everything. But it's a sweet sauce. It seems like I do a lot of cooking down south, and it's more into hard vinegar base, you know. But up in this part of the country, it seems to get sweeter.
Ben, I understand you were originally working in fine dining in Boston, and then you moved to Paxton about 4 years ago. What brought you there?
Actually, I grew up in Paxton, graduated from Paxton, and then ended up in Arizona going to chef school out there, and then Boston as a chef, and kind of bounced around. And then when we had my wife and I had our first kid on the way, we decided to move back where the grandparents were, and that was a unique experience coming back to a town that I hadn't been a part of in so long. And it was neat to reconnect with everybody and see, you know, what downtown needed and try to, you know, jump in and do my part. You know, it's a small town. It's 4,500 people. So opening our barbecue restaurant downtown was a very big deal for the whole area. And, you know, now we draw people in from all around. So it's been really good for the town and really good for my family. You know, it's definitely a family restaurant. So
that's Benjamin Rice, as we're talking to him, owner and chef of the Humble Hog restaurant in Paxton. Pat Burke is on the line with us as well from Murphy's Bureau. He's owner and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering. Nuno Ribeiro's in our Urbana studio with us. He's teaches in the Department of Recreation, Sport and Tourism at the University of Illinois. Nuno, I wanted to ask you about food tourism. What kind of impact do you think even one good restaurant in a small town can have on the local economy?
It has an enormous and often understated impact, because not only does it drive traffic just for day trippers, which we designated as excursionists, but often it's the catalyst to explore the area. So for instance, next to Murfreesboro, you have Shawnee National Forest. How many people knew, for instance, that in a small town like Paxton, there's a beautiful Carnegie Library, which is just a little architectural gem. And I think it's not really understood by the public at large, the immense economic boom that a very good restaurant, which is a destination in itself, an attraction in itself, does for the local economy. So all of these initiatives, which are commendable, things like barbecue trails, like more publicity for locally owned restaurants, especially in smaller places across the state, they're incredibly beneficial to us.
Let's go to one last recommendation, if we can, as we're talking about that. Heather from Oglesby. Hey, Heather, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, where's your favorite place to go for barbecue?
You know what? It's relatively new. It's in LaSalle, Illinois. It's about 10 minutes away from Starved Rock State Park, and they just serve some really amazing house-made barbecue. All their sauces are house-made. They've got a great variety from sweet to spicy. They've got a bourbon sauce and a Carolina mop sauce that's just amazing.
What's it called, Heather?
Hayes Smokehouse.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Sure. Pat, can I ask you about Murfreesboro? We were just talking, Heather was just talking about Starved Rock. Nuno was just mentioning Shawnee National Forest. What do you think went into, a couple people have mentioned now Murfreesboro being the barbecue capital of Illinois. How do you think that came about, all of these different barbecue places in Murfreesboro?
Well, barbecue started in Murfreesboro at the turn of the century, and it's been pretty popular all along. And then along we came along in competition barbecue and won three world championships and ended up being two of us here in town, Mike Mills and myself, ended up on a team that did that. And the name got around real good, but it wasn't just us. It just came up from the early 1900s. And there had been a lot of barbecue places in Murfreesboro, but really noted for it.
And is there a particular, would you say that you all have a particular sauce or style that you think that everybody kind of shares?
Yeah, there are just so many ingredients known to mankind on this sauce and everything. It's the amount that goes into them and what it amounts to. But and then the sweetness of it or the vinegar taste on it, one of the two.
Right. And so is your preference, would you say yours goes closer to more the sweeter than the vinegar?
Yes, it's sweet sauce, and we've got a hint of apple in it. See, this is apple country around Murfreesboro, Illinois. It's called Apple City. And there's a big apple festival here each year in September. And so we got a hint of apple in ours, too.
So, Benjamin, I understand for you guys up in Paxton, you kind of focus a lot also on your brisket, right? What do you think, and how would you describe the sauce that goes along with your brisket?
You bet. Actually, the sauce that goes on the brisket, I kind of took more of an approach of I wanted some tannins in it. Kind of wanted the sauce to just really enhance the meat and not mask it. It is a sweet sauce, kind of like what Pat was saying with his. Just it's got a lot of flavor. You know, we use the freshest spices we can get, just like Pat or anyone else would want to. One of the differentiators with our sauce, we do use a cold pressed organic tomato when we make that. So I like it. It's got enough acidity. It's a pretty well-balanced sauce, but like I said, it doesn't mask the meat. It's really there to enhance it. So, yeah.
Does it make you sad when people put too much sauce on your brisket? It sounds like it would.
You know what? If you want to come in and put ketchup or whatever you want on it, it doesn't affect me emotionally.
But you just think it won't taste as good.
Yeah. Well, you know, we want you to enjoy it however you want to enjoy it, bottom line. But we do get people in from, you know, hey, I'm from Texas. I don't want any sauce on it at all. That's fine, too. We can put the sauce on the side or not at all, whatever. We do serve our sauce warm. So, yeah, you get people that want it drowned in sauce and you get people that want it with no sauce. It's really fine either way.
And Pat, what about, say, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Ben. Go ahead, Benjamin.
I just wanted to say to Pat, if he can hear me, I love his sauce. Pat's restaurant was one of the first barbecue restaurants I went to in Illinois. And I actually got to meet Pat. This was several years ago. I'm sure he doesn't remember, but I just want to say thanks, Pat. You're doing a great job. I really love this place.
I appreciate that, Ben. You know, as Ben said, the meat will stand on its own, you know, and you put put a lot of sauce on it, but not at all. We have a lot of people that they do not want any sauce on it. We have a dry rub we call a sweet and spicy, and they put a little of that on it, but some of them don't want the sauce at all, you know, and then others want to drown it with it.
So both of you gentlemen, I do not want to insult your craft and the time that you take and the care that you prepare with your sauce, but I will ask for those of us who are home cooks and home barbecue, people who are thinking about maybe making something for their families this weekend and they don't have your expertise or your tools, what's the best kind of advice you have for home barbecue chefs? Benjamin, can we start with you?
Sure thing. I'd say start online. I mean, there's an endless resource there with anyone can Google. You can get a really simple recipe with, you know, three or four ingredients, or if you want to go to the grocery store and you know, get 15 ingredients, that's fine too. But you know, you'll see sauces where you can mix them, you know, just a few ingredients together cold and make yourself a sauce. Or you'll have sauces where you got to cook them down a little. There's sauces where you want to put bourbon in them or whatever. Sky's the limit. You could spend your whole career and still not cover it all. So if you're a home cook, pick something that, you know, is more on your level as far as what you have to work with tool-wise, as well as, you know, what your local grocery store will carry. But you don't have to go crazy to make a good sauce. Just like Pat said, you want something that's well-balanced with, you know, enough acidity, so enough vinegar or enough sweet, so you can use molasses or, you know, and ketchup can be the body of it if you want. But they're not hard to make. It's as hard as you want to make it. So, yeah, I'd say check it out online and go from there.
Pat, what about the meat? What kind of meat would you recommend, and what kind of advice would you have for folks in terms of barbecuing?
Well, we do Boston butts for our pulled pork. And of course, we do a loin back rib, and then we do the brisket, too, also. And back to that sauce thing just a little bit here. A lot of people will take something like the Kansas City sauce or the Sweet Baby Ray sauce, something that's been known all over, and then they'll modify that, you know. One thing you got to watch on that is when they're finishing off, do not go on the sauce real early. Hold it off to the last 15 or 20 minutes because it has a tendency to burn with you on it then.
That makes a lot of sense. Obviously, you want to be careful about what you put on the grill. And obviously, because I guess you want to be careful about the sugar content there, right? Because that's just going to caramelize a little bit too early. Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. That's Pat Burke. He's the owner and chef of Pat's Barbecue and Catering in Murfreesboro. I want to thank Benjamin Rice as well. He's owner and chef of the Humble Hog Restaurant in Paxton. And Nuno Ribeiro, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation, Sport, and Tourism. Sorry, Benjamin Grice. Nuno, any final tips for everybody about if they're traveling around this weekend?
Travel, get off the beaten path, and eat good barbecue.
That sounds good. I think everybody, all of us, Benjamin, Pat, Nuno, you probably made everyone go. Everyone who's listening is now going to have barbecue for lunch because I think you made us all really hungry. Thanks so much, gentlemen. Have a great holiday weekend. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
All right, thank you very much.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.